Okay, so we're talking about verb phrases today. We're going to talk about the structure of the verb phrase, and we also have some homework on that as well. So let's jump right into it. Exercise 4 has some revised instructions, revised for this school year, maybe not revised for you because these aren't new to you. You didn't have different instructions. But it says here, identify the verb phrase in the three texts and describe their structure. Finite and non-finite verb forms. So this is something that's very important. We want to look at this. Auxiliaries and lexical verbs. This is also important for us. These kinds of things may or may not show up on your exam, your first exam. And then catenatives, this sequencing or this chain-like building up of verb phrases there. And then with the finite verb phrases, discuss also what processes the verbs denote. And this is page 34 in the booklet, so we can jump over there in a second. Material processes are basically processes of doing. Mental processes are cognition. This is experiencing things. These are verbs of your senses. These are things you believe, for example. And then relational processes. So this is verbs of being in a state or being something or becoming something. Things aren't necessarily neatly clearly cut between these two things. Some verb phrases are much more material processes than others, and some are, say, would typically be material processes, but maybe sort of are presented as if they are mental processes. But we can look at this a little bit later. This is also explained more in the Downing book in section, I believe it's 40, hold on. Material process. Oh, sorry, I typed it in chat. I'm trying to type it into the search here for the book. It's chapters 42. No, I'm sorry, 14, 15. Well, basically 13 to 20, the modules in the second edition. I think they're called, what are they called in this third edition? They're not called chapters. It's in chapter 4 and section. I can't remember what they're called. They're not called modules, though. They changed the name for it. But they explain all the different processes there. But let's go on. We have some things about exercises 2 and 5 on here, and we can come over and look at the exercise 4 in a little bit. Remember that in phase structures, the phase structure is analyzed as a whole, and then the last verb's complement is included in the analysis. So if we have this example of we decided to try to rent a house, then a house is the direct object of the verb rent. It's not the direct object of the verb decided, for example. So it becomes the direct object of the last verb in there. So it's this catenative structure is seen as a whole there. Decided to try to rent like that. Okay. This is going to be important for us, recognizing finiteness and non-finiteness, and recognizing what we do, what is shown through finite and non-finite verb forms, and what these verb forms can do. Finite verb forms can be the main verb in the clause. Non-finite verb forms cannot. Excuse me. When you have a declarative or an interrogative or a clause like that, you're gonna have, if you want to use this, if you want to use the term sentence, maybe that's better. But when you have a sentence, you're gonna have a main verb, and that main verb is gonna show finiteness. either through tense or aspect. So that verb phrase is going to have, either through tense or modality. It's either going to have a tensed verb in it, or it's going to have a modal verb in it. And, you know, aspect has tensed verbs in it. So non-finite verb forms can't do this. They are included in some finite verb phrases. They're non-finite forms, but they can't be on their own as the main verb. Also, non-finite verb forms do not show tense or modality. So when you have a verb phrase with, say, a modal verb, then it's showing modality. It's finite. When you have a verb phrase with a tensed verb, then it's showing tense and it's finite. It gets a little bit tricky because sometimes the tense form looks exactly the same as the bare infinitive. So it can be a little bit tricky like that. But it should be pretty self-explanatory for you. Non-finite verb forms, though, can show aspect and voice. So let's look at some examples. Finite verbs, writes in he writes beautifully. This one's showing tense and person, because person in English is shown on the third person verb form. So verbs that go with the third person, he, she, it, they. No, usually, well, that one's up in the air a little bit. He, she, and it show person on their verbs. They, it depends right now. When you have singular they, it usually takes along or acts like the plural they, but there are other forms of singular they which show person. Anyways, another finite verb form, he wrote to me last week, past tense. So we're showing tense on that one, wrote. And then this one, he has written to me once a week, showing present tense. Tense there, I'll put it here in the chat, tense is shown by has. And then aspect is shown by have plus the past participle. So both of those are showing aspect there. Has written, okay? The written one there, written in this case is a non-finite verb form. And you have your list of non-finites there. Some non-finites here, two infinitives, ing participles, and then the en or ed participle. You've got, you know, to write like that is dangerous. Recognize there's still a finite verb phrase in this clause, which is. He doesn't remember writing that. Writing that is your non-finite verb phrase there. It's the ing participle. Having written the poem, he went out, you get your EN participle there, and the job finished, he went to the pub. So your ED participle. Okay. Now, here's one thing that kind of came up when we were looking at the exercises at the start of class today. And it's something I've wrote in the chat here, and I've sort of explained over the microphone when we were looking at the exercises, but it's important. It's going to be important for our analyses here. So this is from Downing and Locke, and they talk about how auxiliary verbs kind of telescope into the next verb. So aspect, voice, and modality are each made up of two elements. For example, the perfect is have plus the EN. Form of the verb. And so they've got this telescoping thing here. You could have a nice long verb phrase like must have been being driven. And you can see here that modality comes from, you know, your modal verb must plus, and in what follows the modal verb is an infinitive. And then your perfect aspect is shown with have, plus the en form. Then the progressive is shown with a form of b. In this case, it's in the en form because it's part of the perfect aspect. Progressive aspect is a form of b plus the ing form. Passive is a form of b. In this case, it's ing because it's part of the progressive as well, plus the en form. And then you've got your main verb, your lexical verb, driven there. Okay. Two tenses in English. Present tense obviously is used to indicate present time, but more often used in other meanings as well. It's used for repeated or habitual actions. It's used for the future. It's also used for the past. It's used for timeless things, things that always have existed and always will exist or always will be. And it's used for mental states or processes. It's used for the speaker's attitude. It's really important to recognize that tense in language is not time in the real world, right? Time in the real world is something that happens because there are planets moving around. And no matter how we talk, time is still going to happen. And our tense doesn't actually have, well, it has something to do with time and the passage of time and when we're saying something compared to the thing we're talking about happened. But really, what tense is markings on our verbs, right? So tense is, you know, we change our verb form in a certain way. In English, we only got two tenses. We have present and past. So of course they're going to be used to talk about future times and past times and timeless truths. We only have two of them. We have to spread them around. We have to use, you know, if you only got two to work with, then that's what you're going to do. But yeah, try to separate tense from time in your mind, and recognize that, for example, modal verbs, can, could, shall, should, etc., do not show tense, but they are used to refer to different periods of time. Okay, they don't show tense, but so we can refer to different periods of time without using tense in English. Okay, past tense, of course, if we talk about things that happened in before times, before right now when I'm speaking, then I may use past tense, especially if the event is seen as somehow remote or in terms of time or reality. And if the thing that I'm talking about happened and, you know, was completed in the past, in time that already went by, compared to when I'm speaking right now. But past tense is also used for conditionals, hypotheticals. It's used in reported speech or thought. It's used in sometimes when a situation still obtains the present time, it's used. There are pragmatic concerns with past tense. You can sometimes be more polite if you put things in the past tense. So yeah, some more examples of tense and meaning. We choose the tense based on a few different things. We think about the type of action, the state, or the process that the verb denotes. You know, what the verb means, basically, what's involved in it, and then we choose different tenses. Narratives are often written in the past tense. Reporting sequences are in the past tense, right? But this isn't always the case. The descriptions of things or states are presented in the past tense, and an argumentative style often uses the past tense. It depends on what kinds of effects the writer or speaker intends to create and how the reader or hearer interprets the meaning. This isn't the only way, though. I mean, you think about it, you pick up the newspaper, they're often written in the present tense, even though that stuff already happened in the past. But it's still written in the present tense. Okay, two forms of aspect in English. What aspect is aspect is a way of signaling how the lexical verb, the main verb, is to be regarded or experienced. It's a way of presenting a particular view of the action or the meaning of the lexical verb. We have two forms of it in English. We have progressive and we have the perfective. The progressive takes this ing. We're kind of saying that the activity is still in progress or is incomplete somehow. We express dynamic interpretations. We express a temporal frame. If it's punctual or repeated, then we would use the progressive. Something like, I don't know, you hear a kid yell, "Mom, he's hitting me," right? So it's a punctual and repeated. We can express habitual events with some kind of limited duration. The other form is this perfective. So this one is the have plus the en or the ed, past participle. And this is when we have some action in the past that has some bearing on when I'm talking about that action. So has some bearing on either right now when I'm saying the words or sometime that's going to happen after now. So it's a way of looking at the regarding the action in that way. So we can talk about things that have already occurred, but then they somehow have some relevance to right now when I'm talking about the thing. Also, if the event is indefinite or unspecified but related to the present, then we would use that. If the event has some sort of current relevance and is viewed as psychologically connected to speaking time, like I was saying, then we use the perfective there. Did we do three? We didn't do three. So to practice these, we can do exercise three. Maybe we should talk about them a little bit first, and then we can do exercise three maybe for homework. So let's talk about the tenses and the aspects first. Let's take a look at some examples. Because now we've got two tenses and we've also got two aspects. So what I was saying earlier about having, we only have two tenses, so of course we have to refer to all points of time using only these two tenses. We also have two aspects and we can combine these in various ways. So okay, the most simple one is your present simple tense. He skates well. We can put a perfective aspect on that. He has skated all his life. So this is something that obviously the skating is something that started a while ago and now is still relevant right now. So he's still alive and still skating. So it's still happening. If we did the progressive aspect, then we can see this duration here. He is skating at the moment, right? So there's a duration here. He's going to stop, but this is a dynamic process. It's currently going on. Then if we look at the simple past tense, this one I think was pretty self-explanatory. He also skated yesterday, so this is something punctual and then happened and it's done. We combine it with the perfective. We get he had skated in several competitions before he realized it's not for him. So this is something happened and also was completed. And then time went by, and then now I'm telling you about it. So it's doesn't have a bearing or relevancy to when it's being spoken about. The progressive aspect with the past tense, he nevertheless was enjoying skating for fun until his accident. So Again, you can see some duration going on here. So somebody was enjoying skating for fun. They're not necessarily in the moment right now, but it was something that was going on in their life there. And then there's two voices. There's the active and the passive, and their related forms as well. Okay, let's check out modality then. Non-modal utterances. What modality does? And I have a document on Moodle about mood that I can maybe bump up. I think it comes in a later class, but I can bump it up to ours so we can see it. And I can show it to you today. But non-modal utterances, they treat things as reality. So what we do with mood and modality is express some other meanings onto the action or the thing that we're talking about. They express maybe some kinds of, well, it's coming up. Just stay tuned for right now. But non-modal, they treat things as factual. That's how it is. She saw him. This is something that happened. It's a fact. Or they're asserted. He leaves today. It's going to happen. It's a factual thing. It's reality. Bank on it. Modal utterances, on the other hand, they treat the action process with some sort of relation with reality. So they could be non-factual. She must have seen him. So I'm not claiming that it happened, but I'm saying that all the evidence points to it having happened. Or non-asserted. She must leave today, right? Again, I'm not claiming that it will happen, but I'm saying that the evidence points to it, that it will happen, that it is something that is going to happen. There's various ways to express modality. Of course, modal verbs are the one we know about, we've learned about already, but there are some lexical verbs that have a meaning of modality in them. So like allow and command and guess and suggest have some kind of modal meaning with them. The verbs wonder and wish have some modal meaning in them. Later on, we're going to look a little bit about lexicomodal auxiliaries. Have got to, be bound to, had better. Downing and Locke also have this in the book. Hold on a second, I can check it for you. I'll check it later. I can't find it right now. Oops. And then, we talked about our modal auxiliaries and then the semi-modals need and there, which are, they can't do all the things that other modals can. Okay. There's different kinds of modality. There's this epistemic modality. So this expresses this, what we know and how certain we are of the knowledge. So he must have overslept means I'm fairly certain that he overslept. She may be ill. Now, I'm maybe not as certain, but I'm expressing an assumption that she's ill. There's the ontic modality, which talks about what is required of people or what is allowed, what's permitted. So it talks about, it expresses things like roles and statuses of the participants involved in the action. So sort of who is allowed to say what and what is required to be said by or what is required to be done by whom. He must apologize, right? He may or she may take as many as she needs. So requirements, permissions, this kind of thing. Then there's dynamic modality. So this is what people are capable of doing or willing to do. She can speak five languages. I've asked him to help, but he won't. So he will not. He's not willing to do it. These kinds of things. Yeah, let's see what time we got here. Do we take a little break here? Hold on a second. We got a few more slides. Let's do a couple more and then we'll look at the homework. How's that? Okay. Now, all right. So stay tuned for, I don't know, a few more minutes and then we'll stop the recording and we can talk about things. The future. We have to talk about the future, not just your future. You have an exam coming up and there's things you need to know about grammar for the exam, but grammar future and how we talk about the future using grammar, because English doesn't have a future tense. And we know this, right? Other languages also don't have future tenses, but some languages do have future tenses. You may speak a language that has a future tense. So when we want to refer to the future, when we want to talk about things that are going to happen, then what we do in English is a lot of times we'll use a modal verb. We'll use something like will. I mean, obviously nobody knows the future. And so there's no sort of factual knowledge about the future like there is about the present and the past. So we use these, you know, practices of prediction or inference. So it kind of makes sense that a modal verb would be used to talk about the future like that. I'm going to put a big asterisk here because there's claims like, you know, future events are referred to in various ways based on safe predictions, programmed events, intended events. So if somebody uses be going to, then these are for things that they intend to do. And if somebody uses be about to, then these are for imminent events. I personally have not seen enough evidence for these claims. I think that these claims need more evidence. I know that people process language extremely fast in their minds. And I wouldn't be surprised if things did fall in some kind of pattern like that. However, I'm not entirely convinced, but this is how you'll see it presented like that. And if you present it like that, then you'll just be presenting it like grammar books present it. And so you know, there's no danger in doing it like that. I would just like to see some data on it. Because I want to know sort of, you know, how people consider, you know, how certain they are in their predictions. Before choosing a modal or a semi-modal or something like that. I don't know. There's some empirical evidence in the Longman grammar about this, though, which is good. Okay, hands-on taxonomy verb phrases. Let's do some working groups before we get out of here because we got a little bit of time. So it says, work in your home groups and decide who reads which text from the file class 3 texts for verb analysis. Independent work on the text, analyzing on the basis of questions in the file. So I'm going to explain this, and then I'll show you on the Moodle page what's going on here. So what you got to do is you got to there's a file called class 3 text for verb analysis. You got to work on that, decide who's going to read which one, and there's questions in the file. You're free to mark up something if it's tricky or something like that. Spend about 25 minutes on it and then go through the text together in your group, looking at the verb phrases. That's what the assignment is. You can discuss the tricky bits together. But then I want you to write a summary of the main differences between the verb phrases used in the text. So the texts come, there are three different genres and registers. So they're going to have, they're going to be different. And I want you to write a summary of the differences in the verb phrases that are used, right? So if one has more modals and one doesn't, one different tenses, this kind of stuff, then there's these wiki pages that you can write your notes on. So make sure you, you know, write notes while you're discussing things and then type it up in a summary. There's some stuff for you to look at, page 41 from the booklet, for meanings of verbs. And for identifying the processes here, 33 in the booklet, but then modules 13 and 19 in Downing and Locke, probably the same ones in the ebook, which is just Downing. So check those out. And then we can come back and look at the homework for You know what? Let's get the homework now, and then we can wrap up with the PowerPoint and put that to the side. Okay, so there's chapter four, nominal group, noun phrases from the booklet. Exercise three, which we talked about in this PowerPoint, so do that. And then check out the relevant modules in Downing Locks, so modules 45 to 50, or chapter 10, talking about people and things in the e-version. All right, cool. I'm going to pause the recording now. We can flip over to some other things.